Ships have always been an integral part of commerce, and that was especially true during the 16th through the 19th centuries when they were the key component in the transatlantic trade of cotton, sugar, rum, and people. Approximately 12 million enslaved Africans were transported to the New World in what W.E.B. Du Bois called the most magnificent drama in the last 1,000 years of human history. In Marcus Rediker's new book, The Slave Ship, A Human History, he explores the role those ships played in the development of global capitalism and the drama that played out upon their decks. It's published by Viking, and I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Rediker to the show today. Hello.
Hello, Leonard.
What made you decide to focus on personal accounts of the slave trade, and how did you find them?
Well, this particular study has its origins in about 30 years of research in maritime archives. And slowly, I began to accumulate evidence, some of which had never been seen before, about the slave ships and the slave trade. And then very slowly, it became clear to me that it might be possible to write a history of this chamber of horrors known as the slave ship.
So when you were writing those other books, The Many-Headed Hydra and Between the Devil and Deep Blue Sea, also about maritime themes, slavery just kept on popping up and you thought, someday I have to do a book on this?
It's very hard to study the Atlantic world in the 17th and 18th century without being aware of the centrality of slavery. So it did arise as a possibility, but I must admit it took me a few years longer to accept the responsibility of writing about such a heavy subject.
Slavery has occurred throughout human history, usually between warring factions during which the victorious party would enslave those who had just been defeated. Was the Atlantic slave trade something different? Was it a new thing?
I think it was something new, and in fact, people in the 18th century were conscious that the slave trade and the Atlantic system of slavery were something new. And what made it new was that people were literally, in many cases, being worked to death as they produced for a dynamic new world economy. The level of exploitation and brutality in the American slave system, and by that I do mean North America, the Caribbean, and Latin America, was something, I think, that had a special violence attached to it.
But there's also something that's happening here. We have this triangle trade between Europe, Africa, and the New World. The slaves weren't being brought to Africa, to Europe on the whole. There were a few in Europe, but it was definitely European traders going to Africa and then bringing slaves to the Americas.
Exactly. There was most of the slave trade was organized by the great maritime powers of Northwest Europe. Portugal and England played especially important roles. And what they did was go to West Africa to buy human bodies to labor on the plantations of the Western Atlantic.
And how lucrative were the profits?
The profits in the slave trade were high, although they were also risky in the sense that you could make tremendous amounts of money, but you could also lose everything to either high mortality or perhaps a slave insurrection.
Now, many people have pointed out that buying and selling slaves was common within Africa. What made the Middle Passage different?
Slavery in Africa was a quite different kind of institution in which individual slaves could rise to positions of high power, who were treated frequently as family members. But once someone was sold to the European traders, something different happened. This was a very brutal kind of trade. Violence and terror, I've argued, were the central principles of the slave ship. And what awaited people in the New World was a harsh life of labor that was unlike anything they would have known in Africa.
And they couldn't escape at some point and return to their village because that would have been impossible.
Almost always impossible. There are instances of few people being transported to West Africa and managing to find their way back home, but that is most uncommon.
Slavers, as the slave ships were called, would travel for months around the coast of Africa collecting a human cargo. What was the relationship between the ship captains and the African slave traders?
The ship captains had to be very sophisticated businessmen in order to conduct their trade with a wide variety of African traders. And frequently, these slave ships would gather their cargo not from one central place, but from many. So these captains and the African slave traders had a kind of community of interest, and they cooperated quite well.
And how did the process of obtaining slaves work? The Africans would get the slaves and then hold them until the slavers showed up in port?
It varied according to where one was on the west coast of Africa. There are some places where there were big fortresses that would house hundreds of enslaved people, and a slave ship captain might get a full cargo there. But more commonly, these slave traders would go from one port to another, buying just a few people at each stop.
Were there ever any instances, a listener asks, of white Europeans going inland and capturing black Africans?
There were, in fact, such instances. Those tended to be common in the early phases of the trade in the 16th century, early 17th century. But that was not preferred by the Europeans because that tended to create animosity that might then disrupt the flow of the slave trade later on. They wanted predictable business relationships with the African traders.
So again, that triangle, Europe, Africa, the Americas.
Absolutely.
And you got a lot of the writings of captains. Now, they were absolute sovereigns of their ships. They had to keep not just the slaves in check, but also their crews in check. And it was a hard time getting crews, wasn't it? Was this not considered a good job for a sailor?
Most sailors preferred to avoid the slave ship if they could. Now, it's true that there were some advantages. The wages were a little higher, and most importantly, advance pay was offered to sailors in an effort to get them to go aboard. But what impressed me is that many of the sailors who found themselves on slave ships were really not there by a choice of their own. They had fallen into debt. Some had been gotten drunk by a ship captain and taken aboard the vessel and might literally awake on an outward-bound ship on the way to West Africa.
And why was this considered a lousy job? Is it because disease might have been a concern, or were people just horrified by what they were expected to do on these ships?
Well, it was a lousy job for a lot of reasons, and mortality would have been one of the chief reasons.
I mean, the sailors were dying as well as the slaves.
The sailors died in roughly the same proportions as the slaves, although of different causes and at a different sort of chronology. But any given crew could expect to lose 20% over the course of the entire voyage.
How many slaves did that mean over the course of the history of slavery? Does anybody know?
Well, we actually know quite a bit about the business side of the trade. The slave mortality was also quite high. For the full duration of the trade, somewhere around 15%, with a slight decline in the 18th century. But I think the key point is this. Death, premature death, was commonplace on the slave ship for both sailors and especially the enslaved.
The number I've read for slaves is 1.5 million people. That's an awful lot of people dying. Was there any legal implication for killing a slave?
Well, this was something that the abolitionist movement fought very hard for. For many years, in fact, you could say centuries, slave ship captains had the power to do whatever they wanted. But a case in 1781 around the slave ship Zong, in which 122 people were thrown overboard, resulted in a great agitation by those opposed to the slave trade.
I would have thought that it would be in the best interest of a captain to keep the slaves in check so that they won't rebel, but at the same time healthy enough so that they would be attractive to buyers.
This was always the preference. You wanted to deliver as many enslaved people as you could alive to the Western Atlantic in order to maximize profits. But there were instances in which, as on the Zong, a man thought that he could throw people overboard and collect insurance premiums on them. There was also an instance in which captains would sometimes be paid according to the average value of the slave, thereby the entire slave cargo, thereby giving them an incentive to throw overboard the sick ones who were not likely to bring a good price at market.
There were mutual... Well, first of all, I should tell people my guest is Marcus Rediker, R-E-D-I-K-E-R. His latest book, The Slave Ship, A Human History, published by Viking. There were mutual aid societies that developed among slaves aboard the ship, even though they came often from different tribes and couldn't speak the same languages.
This, I would say, Leonard, is one of the most powerful things that I found in the course of doing this research.
I'd never heard of it before.
Well, what happened was that these multi-ethnic Africans thrown together on the lower decks of a slave ship began to find out what they had in common, developing new kinds of language, new kinds of communication, music, dance, and resistance. This is crucial. Resistance against a common oppressor did bind people together. So what I've argued is that African-American culture does in some ways begin on the ships, and that there is a hopeful and creative aspect to it.
Because these, in some cases, are people who might have been at war with each other back home.
In some cases, they were certainly at war with each other. But I think what many found, not all, there are instances of fights and conflict breaking out among the enslaved. But what people found was that they had a bigger problem than each other when they found themselves aboard the slave ship.
Did they have any successful uprisings?
There are some successful instances. Those usually occurred when they were still within the sight of land in Africa, and a ship might be captured and people take the boats and row ashore.
Well, there was the added problem for many of these slavers of piracy. What happened if a pirate took over the ship? Did they just simply take the slaves for themselves?
In some cases, pirates took the slaves for themselves. In other cases, pirates liberated the slaves. There's actually a very interesting history here and on which a number of people are now working that shows that African people often ended up working as pirates on board those ships.
What part did slave merchants like Henry Lawrence, who became president of the Continental Congress in 1777, play in supporting the system?
Well, Henry Lawrence was one of the leading early American slave traders. He was a man who accumulated tremendous wealth and moved literally to the apex of early American society.
And did he justify his actions simply because he made a lot of money?
Well, there were a lot of, I would say, racist arguments in play at the time that by taking these so-called savage Africans and bringing them into a superior British or American civilization and Christianizing them, you were doing them a favor somehow. This is the way that slave traders justified to themselves what they were doing.
I've even read that argument more recently on more subtle levels. Then there's the other side of the story. John Newton, who wrote Amazing Grace, many people point out that he had been a slaver captain.
Yes, he had. John Newton was a man who wrote Amazing Grace. He's famous for that. I'm afraid there's a myth out there about how this happened. The myth would say that he was working on a slave ship. He had an epiphany, a religious awakening. He wrote Amazing Grace as penance and the rest.
I was blind and now I see.
But I'm afraid it didn't happen that way. John Newton experienced his Christian conversion when working as a first mate on a slave ship. He then went as captain three more times, working and carrying people into bondage as a devout Christian. He never made a decision to retire from the sea. He had a stroke. And then 19 years later, he wrote Amazing Grace. And then another 14 years after that, he finally made his first public statements against the slave trade.
What about the general public? Were they aware of the conditions on these ships?
I think most people were not aware of them, and the abolitionist movement in both Britain and the United States took it as their task to make what happened on these ships known to the reading public, and so they agitated around this issue.
Well, Britain outlawed the slave trade in 1807. The United States banned it in 1808, and interestingly, Thomas Jefferson was one of the people who was for that ban in this country because it was felt that there were enough slaves anyway. It didn't really matter. We'd just breed new ones.
Jefferson's opposition to the slave trade is interesting because as someone in the Chesapeake area in Virginia who owned quite a few slaves, the abolition would in fact have made his own slaves worth more. So there were a number of Virginia planters who supported the trade, but at the same time insisted on the primacy of the institution of slavery.
And slave trade continued anyway, just illegally.
That is correct.
In your introduction, you note that this was a painful book to write and that if you've done your job, it should be painful to read. Why is it important for us to examine these violent periods in human history?
Leonard, I think that we are still living with the consequences of the sailing of these slave ships. And I think that the dark pages of our history are something that we need to take on board. I think we have to address the great and historic injustice that slavery and the slave trade represent.
Well, many people object to the idea of reparations, although there are quite a few African Americans who think it's a good idea. How would we work reparations?
Well, I think there are many different ways that this could be done. I don't think it's my place as a historian to say how it should be done. I think this should be decided by a social movement made up and led by people who have suffered most from the legacy of racism and slavery. But I think there are a great many ways in which we could make positive steps to overcome this legacy.
Well, I suspect there are fortunes that were made on this. There are universities that were built on it, as we've discovered at Brown. And I don't know if there's enough money today to come up with any serious reparations. But
well, in my view,
this is a lasting legacy.
It's a lasting legacy, and it's much bigger and deeper than a few companies corporations that might still be in existence. We're talking about an institution of slavery that created tremendous wealth and not only individual wealth, but business wealth and the wealth upon which the government itself was based. So I would not be happy with limiting the discussion just to this or that surviving corporation from the 19th century.
Marcus Rediker is a professor of history at the University of Pittsburgh. The Slave Ship, A Human History, which is published by Viking, is his latest book, and he will be giving a talk and signing books tomorrow night at 8 o'clock at the South Street Seaport Museum at 213 Water Street at 6 o'clock tomorrow. I'm sorry, so you might want to stop by and say hello.